The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Best part is that the statute anticipates that there will, of course, be circumstances in which the president encounters a new potential associated force and wants to so designate them. In the decade and a half old practices that the executive branch makes such a determination, and there are certain ways in which these days Congress may not be notified about it. It's not clear that the public would ever be told. I use the example of AQIM. They may be in now, we just don't really know. And that to me is one of the things that's critical to bear in mind as we look at this part of who's covered. The president is given authority, and it's sort of recognized in the statute. Not sort of, is recognized in the statute. The president can name additional associated forces that meet the definition, which we'll talk about in a second. But he's then got to notify Congress and issue a written justification for it, and then it triggers fast-track review procedures. Of course, it's always the case that Congress can decide to try to legislate, so how is this different? The thing that's different is that the procedural obstacles that ordinarily could have things buried in committee are overridden by statute such that some member is going to step up and say, I want there to be a bill to overturn that decision about an associated force. It can't just be buried by the chair of the committee, and it can't, you know, avoid the light of day that way.
I'm Susan Hennessy, and you're listening to the Lawfare Podcast, April 21st, 2018. Last week, Senators Bob Corker and Tim Kaine introduced a proposal to reshape the legal authorization for U.S. counterterrorism operations abroad. On Thursday, I sat down with Bobby Chesney, co-founder of Lawfare and a professor at the UT Austin School of Law, and Scott Anderson, Lawfare's senior editor and former State Department lawyer, to talk about the proposal. We discussed the current state of the authorizations for use of military force, what the new proposal says, and its prospects in this Congress. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 302, Bobby Chesney and Scott Anderson on the Corker-Kaine AUMF. So let's start with a little bit of background just to get people up to speed. So give me the 2-minute overview of the 2001-2002 authorizations for use of military force.
All right. So right after the 9/11 attacks, the president determined that there had been an armed attack on the United States and that it was going to be categorized as an armed conflict. And you might have had a world in which that was all that ever happened, and it was all done. All further uses of military force could have been under color of Article II commander-in-chief authorities as a matter of national self-defense, but that is definitely not the world we actually ended up living in. Congress, of course, was eager to pass something. There was back and forth between the White House and Congress as to how broad that would be. There was an initial proposal from the White House to have the authorization be to use all necessary and appropriate military force, framed kind of broadly as to all international terrorist threats. There was legislative resistance. And so what ends up getting enacted is an authorization to use all necessary and appropriate military force against those whom the president determines were responsible for the 9/11 attacks and with an eye towards the Taliban, because, of course, by that time, people already understood this was a question of al-Qaeda, but that they were in Afghanistan being harbored by the Taliban. The statute went on to say also those groups the president determines are harboring whatever organization the president identifies as the perpetrator of the 9/11 attacks, all towards the end of preventing future attacks from these groups in the future. And that's about the long and the short of it. There's no geographic limitation. There's no language expressly talking about associated forces. There's no specification as to what the force would be. It just says all necessary and appropriate force, at least against al-Qaeda and the Taliban.
So the 2002 AUMF is a bit of a bit player in this broader schema that we're talking about. It was enacted in late 2002 in the lead up to the Iraq War and provides authorization to the president to use military force to address the threat from Iraq, fairly broad terms, and also to enforce certain UN Security Council resolutions in regards to Iraq. This resolution was very significant for a very long time. It authorized the U.S. military presence in Iraq, a whole range of activities they pursued there. But at this point, since the U.S. troop withdrawal at the end of 2011, it's really been cited primarily for just one thing, and that's as supplemental authorization, redundant with the 2001 AUMF, for a certain set of activities against ISIS, both in Iraq and then in some circumstances in Syria.
So I should probably jump in there and bring us up to speed on some of what develops with the 2001 AUMF to get us to the place where it could be the primary statutory connection to the use of force against the Islamic State. So as I mentioned a moment ago, the original statute just refers to whomever the president thinks carried out the 9/11 attacks and who might harbor them. In Afghanistan, where we had from late 2001 onwards a substantial ground presence, it was not long before it was clear that it wasn't just the Afghan Taliban who was in the field using force against both American forces and allied forces, including what became the allied government of Afghanistan under Karzai, most notably the Haqqani network, which in many ways is intertwined with the Afghan Taliban, but is, depending on how you define these things, a separate entity, and others as well. And so this question sort of arose, though no one in the public was talking about it. What's the statutory justification, if there is one, for using force against those additional groups that we were, at least in Afghanistan, clearly engaging in combat with? And from that basis, the idea that either as a matter of Article 2 national self-defense or force protection, or as an extension, an unwritten but necessarily implied part of the authority in the 2001 statute, there needs to be some sort of provision in the concept or label that ends up being used as associated forces to capture the idea that there are other groups that will join in the fight in a very concrete and real way. And it would be bizarre to claim, oh, you can't shoot against them because they weren't named in the original statute. Now, you might say, well, so as soon as that happened and was recognized, they should have gone back to Congress, gotten an extension. Maybe so, maybe not. But over the course of a decade, but first in Afghanistan and then more broadly, the idea of the implied inclusion of associated forces ends up becoming a central part of the framework. And then this begins to matter a great deal for the primary hostile force, Al-Qaeda, as Al-Qaeda evolves and begins having what to some extent used to be separate groups that were ideologically affiliated or inclined, but ultimately separate, and then local cells of the Al-Qaeda network, either the cells begin to become more separate, having their own independent life and forming sort of separate organizational existence, and then some of the parallel groups begin to formally pledge allegiance to bin Laden. And in places like Yemen, with Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you have groups that the United States feels that it needs to use force against and does use force against, and the associated force concept is the basis for claiming that there is existing statutory authority to do it. And then people have disagreements about how broadly has that idea been extended over time? Has it been overextended? Certainly there are critics who would say the AUMF has been wildly stretched to encompass whichever group in the larger network or on the fringes of the network later on emerges. And there are others who feel that it's a perfectly reasonable extension of the original authority. This got pretty hot when the Islamic State came on the scene because the Islamic State had been Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a classic associated force, but famously had a break with Al-Qaeda's core leadership. There was the dispute over who was in charge of what becomes Jabhat al-Nusra. Zawahiri sides with the Syrian entity as being independent from al-Baghdadi. Al-Baghdadi says, well, in that case, we're independent from all of you, and also we're the Islamic State, and the rest is sort of history. The administration has been claiming that the use of force against the Islamic State all these years since then has been not just under the 2002 AUMF, as Scott mentioned, but also under the 2001 AUMF on sort of a successor associated force theory.
So that's a good sort of summary of the past kind of 15 years of on-the-ground reality. I think it's worth thinking a little bit about what has been kind of the congressional or the AUMF procedural discussions that have occurred. So certainly the draft we're talking about right now is not the first time that they've tried to enact a new AUMF. I think that at this point or a year ago, people might have assumed, you know, there's like three senators and three people who write for Lawfare, and that's the sum total of the universe of people still focused on the AUMF. It seems like this is more promising. something. Is that wrong? Is this just as sort of doomed and hopeless as past efforts to enact new AUMFs? Or do you think that the context here is significantly different, sort of something shifted?
Well, you know, the one thing that this resolution seems to have in support of it, or this bill, excuse me, is that it has the support of Senator Corker, who's the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and of a bipartisan coalition of a number of people who have been very involved in this issue, leaders on this issue, and are influential members of their party and on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, including Senator Kaine from Virginia, Senator Flake. The two of them have worked together on prior proposals in this area in the past. So there is reason to believe, and Bobby may have a little bit better sense of the politics on this, but my sense is there's certainly reason to believe this is going to get serious consideration in the committee, a debate in the committee. There's a reasonably good chance it'll get out of the committee. The real question then is how the majority leadership in the Senate treats it, and then what happens on the House side, because I don't think we have as good a sense of that at this point.
So I think that you're absolutely right, Scott, that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is absolutely, they're going to mark up this bill for sure. That was made clear. They may have a hearing. I assume they'll have a hearing on it. And I would imagine it's going to come out of there in some way or fashion. Majority Leader McConnell had said the other day, in the same conversation in which he suggested that he wasn't interested in bringing the special counsel protection bill to the floor, he mentioned in passing that he wasn't particularly interested in bringing any AUMF renewal bill to the floor and had a passing comment about how, well, what's the need? We don't need that. Everything's fine the way it is. Whether he'll change his mind ultimately, and then whether there will be any House analog, let alone whether the White House would sign it, very hard to say. If we were trying to imagine what could explain why now there might be political space to do this, whereas there wasn't before, there does have to be a forcing function, I believe. We've had many rounds, as Susan mentioned, of flirtation with AUMF renewals. And I think most of us who follow this stuff feel that there was little chance any of it ever was going to go anywhere in a context in which, A, there was no justiciable case pending in a court with the federal judge in a position to say, actually, the government does not have authority under the existing AUMFs to do what it wants to do. Why not? Because there are no Islamic State detainees in U.S. custody in the United States. I'll come back to that in a minute. But we don't have any Islamic State detainees at Gitmo. For a long time there, it didn't seem like there were ever going to be any such detainees or any other fact patterns that would potentially cause a federal judge to say, actually, you're wrong about your interpretation of the AUMF being as broad as you claim it is. So no forcing function. Yes, we were using force, but two decades of experience have conclusively proven that we're not going to have litigation in U.S. federal courts about those uses of force. It's detainee cases that can create that judicial forcing function. So that was one thing. The other thing was, under Obama and now Trump, the White House has been very clear that it does not think it lacks authority. Under Obama, they said we would like fresh authority if it's the right kind of fresh authority. Trump may or may not feel the same way, but everyone's at great pains to insist that as things stand, they're going to keep going about what they're already doing. And in that environment, you're basically telling Congress that there's no great need for this. It's just the right thing to do. And I can almost hear the laughter. There's no microphones here, but I can almost hear the laughter out there when we talk about that being a good enough argument to get Congress to legislate.
I do think it's worth noting that we have an opinion from the Trump administration on this, a skeptical one, right? In hearings at the end of last year, and I think it was October, we saw then Secretary of State Tillerson and Secretary of Defense Mattis come before Congress, before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and say, we oppose any new authorization for the use of military force that would restrict our geographic scope, impose any timelines, restrict us operationally, restrict us in any way that the current AUMF does not. The one thing they were willing to sign off on is some sort of new blessing from the Senate, where they would say, everything you're doing is great, but we're not taking away the prior authorization.
So a ratification bill.
Essentially, yes. Essentially a ratification of the interpretations that the executive branch has implemented, as Bobby described, over the last several years, removing the underlying legal risk that comes with these theories they've relied on, of which some people have been skeptical. Although, as Bobby articulates, there are very limited avenues by which those are likely to be tested, certainly outside of the detention context. There are a couple of hypothetical cases where it has or it could potentially, but they all seem unlikely to succeed, certainly in my view.
So that's as good a transition as any to sort of get into the specifics of the current legislation. So Senators Corker and Kaine have introduced this bill. You know, let's sort of talk about what is included within it. You know, I think the first question is, we had the authorities that existed under these prior AUMFs. If this new legislation is enacted, what remains of that authority that existed before?
So this is really interesting. You have to read the bill really carefully to appreciate quite what it does here. Remember, as we've emphasized here, there's two existing statutory authorizations that have been cited vis-a-vis our current major combat operations in Iraq and Syria. It's both the 2001 and the 2002 AUMFs. And then, of course, we use the 2001 AUMF elsewhere as well. So the new bill, if enacted, would repeal both the prior AUMFs, but as to and only as to the 2001 AUMF, it goes out of its way to say, you know, kind of complete carryover of authority, no change, no loss of authority. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing here, but that's almost the way it feels when you read it, because it actually says it in two different places. We really, really mean it. No loss of authority under the 2001 AUMF, even if we don't, you know, if there's any way to express that, we're saying that. And the reason why they're at such pains to underscore that claim is that there's a public statement from acting DOD General Counsel Bill Castle questioning and raising the danger that a repeal and replace of the 2001 AUMF might endanger some unspecified portion of the legal architecture that's been built up for counterterrorism over the past two decades. And so the clear intent of the bill is to say, look, to the extent that human language can express that that's not the will of Congress, that indeed we want it to carry over 100% without loss, that's what we're saying. But they don't say anything of the kind as to the 02 AUMF. That's just repealed. And so it raises an interesting question. Is there anything as a practical matter that could turn on it if you enacted that legislation? And my speculation is that the only thing I can think of where that would fit, it obviously couldn't be any situation in which there's a plausible associated forces of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban argument, because the 01 AUMF authority carried over would cover that. So what's the delta? It would have to be something that has a plausible connection to events in Iraq, and that draws to mind possibility of using force maybe in some way or fashion against an Iranian target, IRG or something like that, where there's no way you're going to show, I don't think, that it's an associated force of Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, or the Taliban, but you could make arguments about it pertaining to the security and stability of Iraq, depending on what the fact pattern was. And so that is being quietly taken off the table as a possibility. Scott, what do you think? Does that sound crazy?
No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the 2002 AUMF that's going away and does not have this continuation authorized a very broad range of activities for a very long time. A lot of nation building stabilization type activities cited this authorization, involvement in working against both Sunni and Shia groups, Iranian affiliated militia groups, different groups that turned into AQI. There are other groups as well that aren't necessarily Iran associated, that aren't necessarily AQI associated, the Naqshbandi group and a few other groups that are kind of Ba'ath Party holdovers that have been active in the past. Many of those were kind of rolled into ISIS as ISIS rolled out in 2014. You know, some of them may still be active. I'm not currently aware of that. So there is a little bit of a delta that could be relevant here, but one can also imagine particularly the nexus between those groups and ISIS that's emerged since 2014. There could be arguments that they are fit under the new associated force authority under this new 2018 AUMF. I do think it's worth going back and thinking about this continuing operations concept in the 2001 AUMF, because it actually creates kind of interesting problem in that the AUMF, the new AUMF, I should say, essentially says all the activities that are ongoing as of the date it is enacted under the 2001 AUMF will be carried over. And then it says, you also have to tell us what the entities we're targeting are, the associated forces, and the countries you're operating in, all of which would reveal 99% of what's happening underneath the AUMF. But there are, in theory at least, other activities that the Trump administration or prior administrations could have pursued or may be pursuing that may raise more eyebrows and get grandfathered in, that may raise some questions. The one that popped out to me when I read this immediately is there have been instances in the last year where the AUMF has been cited as authorization to engage in exchanges of hostilities with the Assad regime and Assad regime forces when they've threatened members of our counter-ISIL coalition. Presumably, that would be carried over by this kind of broad extenuating authorities clause. It wouldn't be making Syria and associated force that's actually barred under the new AUMF, which doesn't allow that to extend to sovereign states, unlike the prior AUMF, at least on its plain face. But, you know, it is getting grandfathered in. Maybe that's okay. Maybe there are good reasons for it. But it's notable because Senator Kaine, particularly one of the sponsors of the new AUMF, has been very concerned about this, asked lots of questions at hearings, submitted letters about it. So I'm a little curious as whether we may see some motion there. an easy way to fix that really would be just to pin the continuing authorities to some sort of disclosure mechanism, some sort of report about the activities they are pursuing under the current AUMF. We have that now in the form of this Section 1264 report the last NEAA installed, which maybe this could be tied to. As written, I understand the purpose of it, but I'm a little worried it may have a little bit broader scope than some people may realize. But those are all very isolated cases, I will concede.
So that's interesting. I hadn't thought too much about that as an area of concern. And I think it depends on how much one has fear about how the category, which I'm going to restate to see if we're on the same page in a moment, how much people are concerned that category might get taken advantage of in an unreasonable way. The category would be a situation, whether it's Syria or anyone who's not otherwise covered by the AUMF, nonetheless is in a situation where their forces are threatening our allies who were engaged in a counter-Islamic State operation, or it could be a counter-Al-Qaeda operation. And then in the nature of collective self-defense of those forces, we come in on an isolated basis to use force to protect them. And that actually, you know, famously happened not that long ago with Syrian government, or well, it was Russian proxy forces, but Syrian regime-friendly forces approaching U.S.-supported anti-Islamic State forces. That sort of extension of unit self-defense to allies in the field doesn't concern me, as long as it's really applied, you know, with necessity and proportionality the way that it was. I guess you're putting your finger, Scott, on the possibility that there could be some wiggle room there where that's exploited to go much further by a sort of an immediate threat. Sure, that's obvious, but sometimes there are less obvious, less immediate threats. It certainly wouldn't be harmful, especially if you use the idea of carving out states as a separate category to police against it. It might be tricky to use language to pin that down. I'm not too worried about it, but I take your point on it.
Before we get too deep into sort of, you know, the specifics of how this operates, it's probably worth taking a step back, just saying who's covered by this AUMF? How does this sort of associated forces procedures designations work? So as a threshold question, you know, who does it cover?
So there, yeah, right. What's the point of this? Is it just saying 2001 AUMF, let's do it some more? No, it says let's do it some more. And let's be clear this time about which organizations are covered. So there are three moving parts here, and the first two are real simple because they're just lists of specific named organizations. As an initial matter, the primary objects, if you will, of the AUMF are, as roughly they have been, Al-Qaeda, specifically named this time, the Afghan Taliban, specifically named this time, and then there's a third name, and not surprisingly, it's the Islamic State. So any questions about whether there's statutory authorization for the use of force against the Islamic State would be settled there. And then there's the category of associated forces, which we've been talking about, and there's two subparts. First, there's an explicit naming of a handful of groups, five of them, as groups that definitely count already by statute as associated forces. Let me quickly run through those and flag that some of it's totally unsurprising, and then at least one part's actually, I think, rather surprising. The unsurprising parts are that AQAP in Yemen is named, the Haqqani Network is named. Neither of those is any surprise at all. Those are longstanding associated forces. Al-Shabaab is named. And for those of us who follow this stuff closely, that's not novel. That's not new. That's been for a little while now, the state of affairs there. That might be a surprise to other people. Then you've got one that is quite surprising, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. Okay. So Al-Qaeda in Syria, just real quick there, that's Jabhat al-Nusra, the other Al-Qaeda presence that wasn't AQI, that was in the fight with AQI over independence, the Syrian Al-Qaeda operation. Not surprising. AQIM, that's the former, originally known in Algeria as the Salafist Group for Call and Combat. This is a Salafist extremist organization that was certainly in the Al-Qaeda ideological and theological orbit, but was independent for a long time, had leadership changes, eventually decided to buy into the Al-Qaeda organization and adopted the moniker Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. I have not yet seen, and Scott, you may know different, or Susan, you may know different, I had never seen any public reference to AQIM as having qualified collectively as an associated force engaged in hostilities against the United States. Certainly, there have been a handful of instances over time where particular AQIM-linked individuals had been targeted for force by the United States, but always on an individualized basis. So I think this may reflect that maybe AQIM has already gotten the designation. The public just doesn't know about it. Or, a little bit harder to believe, maybe Corker and Kane decided to jump the gun on that. This, to me, is a pretty strong signal that probably this decision's been made internally. And I will note there was a use of force in southwest Libya not long ago against AQIM targets. And I had analyzed it as an individual case, but maybe the actual answer is no. They're an organizationally included entity. In any event, don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole because I haven't told you the best part yet. The best part is that the statute then anticipates that there will, of course, as there has been in the past, be circumstances in which the president encounters a new potential associated force and wants to so designate them. And here's the critical thing. You have to think about this through the lens of where are we under the decade and a half old practice? And the decade and a half old practice is that the executive branch makes such a determination. And there are certain ways in which now, these days, Congress may not be notified about it. Under the Section 1264 process that Scott mentioned a moment ago, it's more clear now than it ever used to be that Congress would be told. It's not clear that the public would ever be told. And again, I use the example of AQIM. They may be in now. We just don't really know. And that, to me, is one of the things that's critical to bear in mind as we look at this final or third part of who's covered. The president is given authority. The president is given authority, and it's sort of recognized in the statute. Not sort of, is recognized in the statute. The president can name additional associated forces that meet the definition, which we'll talk about in a second. But he's then got to notify Congress and issue a written justification for it, which can be at least partially classified. And then it triggers fast-track review procedures. Of course, it's always the case that Congress can decide to try to legislate. So how is this different? The thing that's different is that the procedural obstacles that ordinarily could have things buried in committee in Congress are overridden by statute such that as long as some member, you know, looking at you, Rand Paul, as long as some member is going to step up and say, I want there to be a bill to overturn that decision about an associated force, it's going to be on a fast track. We'll get floor argument, I believe. Scott, you may have to clarify if that's quite how it works. But it's at least, it can't just be buried by the chair of the committee, and it can't, you know, avoid the light of day that way. So last thing before turning it back over to you to talk about how all these fast track procedures actually work, there is a definition of associated forces. It's got two parts. One part is basically just a codification associated force definition used by both the Obama administration and I think the Bush administration, certainly the Trump administration. It has some language in it that's interesting we could get into about when it applies vis-a-vis groups that are only attacking our coalition partners in the field as opposed to the United States. That's not novel either. The only thing that's novel is the part where it clarifies that a successor force, and that's the Islamic State scenario, a successor of an otherwise qualified group would still count as well. Okay, so that's what the bill authorizes. And of course, you can see where critics might say, maybe that was the case before, but now you're putting into statute that the president can pick who it covers. That's a bad idea, especially with this president. We don't want to do it. Status quo is, that's how it works anyways. So then the question becomes, in exchange for confirming that the status quo is okay, is there an additional constraint in the form of this the sunset provision or the fast track voting? Scott, what do you think?
Sure. Well, before I get back to the fast track, I think I'll throw in two more observations here. The first is that that's absolutely right. I think the most important kind of integral part of this bill is this associated force designation process. There's a similar process for foreign countries that it's operating in as well, where similarly, if the president chooses to expand military operations to another foreign country, they also have to notify Congress, and Congress can take the exact same step to initiate this legislation.
Just to be clear on that, that's if we're using force against a covered group, non-state actor in that country, not going after that government.
100% correct. Yes, that should be very clear. And again, to reiterate, the one significant change here is that sovereign countries are excluded from the scope of associated forces. So in theory, this could never be used to directly authorize the use of force against a foreign state, with the only possible minor exception of that kind of secondary or tertiary authorization I mentioned before about defending a force. That's part of the reason why I think it's notable. But regardless, so there is this process involved with associated forces designation, and then similarly with foreign country designation, because the 2001 AUMF, again, to go back to the status quo, has no geographic limits whatsoever. And then there is this quadrennial review process that started us down this path. And the quadrennial review process essentially says that starting on January 20th, 2022, so that will be the anniversary of the inauguration day of the next president, or the next presidential term, if it's still President Trump, so 1 year into that next presidential term, the president has to deliver a report to Congress saying, here's all the things I'm using the AUMF for, and then present a recommendation, whether they keep it as is, modify it, or repeal it. And then Congress has a period in which it can again use these fast-track procedures, just like it does with the associated force designations, just like it does with the foreign country designations, to consider legislation to either modify or repeal the AUMF. So let's get into these fast-track procedures, because they really are kind of the tooth of the bill, the idea that these are the things that changes Congress's hand. What they essentially do is that they change the rules of the House and the Senate. And this is notable because the House and the Senate under the Constitution have their own authority to make their own rules. So it introduces a set of rules to just how they debate these bills that in theory can be superseded by the House or the Senate in future Congresses. There's not an easy way around that because of the way the Constitution lays out these authorities, but it's worth noting. And the bill acknowledges that explicitly on its face. These fast-track procedures then do essentially two things, as I understand from talking, I will say, to my colleague Molly Reynolds, who is a Congress expert, because I do not know these procedures like the back of my hand like
no
she does.
No one knows these procedures.
No one knows these procedures like Molly does. But essentially how they work is on the House side, it guarantees that the committee has a period of 10 days in which to debate, again, one of these resolutions to have one of these effects. After 10 days, it gets put on the calendar of the House. From there on, it doesn't dictate any more procedure, doesn't guarantee a debate in the House, as far as we can tell. Part of that may be a matter of etiquette, because this is a draft proposed by the Senate. Perhaps they didn't want to step into the House's business and start dictating procedures. Not sure, but the bill as currently drafted doesn't go further than that on the House side. On the Senate side, it does. It actually directs any such bills to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Again, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee has up to 10 days after the first 30 days in which it could be introduced. So 40 days, essentially max, to consider this, at which point it's discharged onto the floor of the Senate. And then at any point, a motion to proceed to debate on the matter is in order. And so this is basically a motion on whether to start debating the actual act underneath, the actual resolution that would modify this AUMF somehow. Debate on that is limited. So that individual motion to proceed could in itself be filibustered. That's as far as it goes. So it guarantees that there is going to be a debate about this underlying legislation, this underlying resolution. It's not on the resolution itself. It's on whether to proceed to it. But, you know, symbolically, it certainly gives a chance to debate it on the floor. And then there's a very good chance you'll get to a vote again on that motion to proceed or not. The actual underlying legislation is not protected by filibuster, as far as we can tell. So it's still subject to a filibuster, unlike the motion to proceed. So essentially, you're, again, guaranteed, I think, Bobby summarized this way accurately, is that you're guaranteed that the Senate, at least, is going to get a floor debate on this. And that's about as far as these procedures go. I don't think that's insignificant. In fact, a lot of other national security-related legislation and another legislation uses this as a tool now, because this is a tool by which the Senate can say, we're going to bring attention to this issue, we're going to build political opposition by forcing votes where that's an option. You know, we're going to call out people on their views, make it easier to hold them accountable. And so this isn't a totally insignificant measure. And I think people who dismiss it too out of hand aren't doing justice and are frankly ignoring the way the Senate does a lot of its work these days. But it doesn't increase the odds of actually enacting this on the straight numbers. And we know that most importantly because it does not, and in fact could not legally, change the fact that all this legislation will eventually have to be presented to the president for signature and he can veto it. And then you would still need 2/3 of both houses to override that veto. It, again, does give a little bit of expedited procedures for considering an override motion in the Senate, limiting the time and spreading it among two parties, but that's about it. And so it doesn't change the fundamental balance of kind of the voting structure, but it does introduce these additional political tools that the Senate can use to at least have a little more leverage over the situation.
And I think for critical context on that, just consider how many associated forces, we don't know, have been designated over time. There's never been floor debate about any of those designations, period. It's just never happened. So this would be different in that respect. And so, Scott, you're totally right that it wouldn't change the prospects of actually passing legislation to override a president's decision to add, as I said on National Security Law podcast with Steve Vladeck the other day, say he announces there's Al-Qaeda in North Dakota and they're covered. Well, you know, it's still every bit as hard to pass legislation to overturn that as it used to be, but the public would find out. And there would be debate. We would know. And whatever good could come from that, if it is a decision that deserves to be scrutinized intensely and maybe rejected, it's better than the status quo. So I think a lot of the reactions to this bill, it's about trying to figure out how to quantify the cost and benefits for those who are concerned about overly expansive interpretations, how much benefit is there in that daylight provision? So to kind of come back to Susan's framing question, you know, is this really a sunset provision? It's definitely not a sunset provision. You might say it's a sunrise provision. If a sunrise provision is understood to mean that the rays of light start to shine on something that otherwise takes place in the dark, I think that's what it's doing. And I think that's not nothing.
So you have the pen in hand, you know, you can make changes to your ideal version of this draft. Do things sort of stand out where there needs to be tweaks, where there's an opportunity for sort of wholesale changes to be made? What are your dream AUMF provisions? I know you have.
Yeah, well, I would, first of all, you know, it'd be a Christmas tree. I'd hang ornaments all over it, all my special pet projects. But if we had some sort of germaneness requirement, we had to only alter it on its own terms. You know, there were a lot of bells and whistles that when Ben Wittes, Jack Goldsmith, Matt Waxman, and I wrote a paper for Hoover's, God knows how many years ago it was now, sort of floating the idea of AUMF reform long before this happened, we paired a presidential designation and congressional review type mechanism with a lot of constraints. You know, there was language about expressly recognizing that the law of armed conflict governs. And that should be the rule anyways. That's probably the best reading of Hamdi's interpretation of the 2001 AMF, but it'd be better to have that in statute, including a sunset. I think that a sunset is not the disaster a lot of...
A true sunset.
A real sunset is not the disaster people... I would certainly schedule it for a non-election year to the extent that that would help. But on this one, I'm trying to think of other things that I would certainly add. I think the most important thing I wish was clear, I think as a practical matter, this happens, but I'd love for it to be said expressly. When the president would make a new designation of an associated force, and that designation has to be, you know, memorialized in writing and sent over to Congress with the justification, the language currently says the justification can be classified as needed. It should be made clear that the identity of the organization that's being designated as an associated force has to be stated publicly. Because that's what's going to provide the external pressures and accountability to really press on that issue. And frankly, I think we can all agree that we ought to know the groups against whom we've authorized the use of force.
Scott, your pet changes you want to see made?
Well, they're a lot like Bobby's, if I'm being completely honest. The public transparency angle, I think, is an important one. You know, the idea that we need to know who these associated forces are and the way the AUMF is being used, I think that should be extended a little bit, maybe to some of these other extenuating authorities, just insofar as there may be little slices that may not be covered by the associated force bet. But, you know, I think public transparency really should be a priority. We've seen Congress take it seriously recently in a lot of new reporting requirements in regards to other authorities in this 1264 provision. But I don't think any of those have come out with the level of public transparency as we're hoping for. In the 1264 context, the Trump administration ended up filing a largely classified report. A lot of information relevant to this was in there, and then did not even release the unclassified version publicly. It was ultimately procured initially by us and then later by the New York Times in actual kind of PDF format. But regardless, I think this public transparency is worth pushing on a lot of different fronts, and certainly on this front as well. The sunset is the other one, and I really do think a sunset is really essential here. I think the absence of a sunset is the original sin of the 2001 AUMF. A lot of these other measures about expanding the scope of operations, whether it's a different foreign country, a different associated force, there's a policy logic behind that. There's an operational logic. Maybe you want a cabinet. Certainly you want to have debate about it. Certainly you want to have public transparency about it. But it's a type of delegation that we see Congress do in a variety of contexts. And we can debate about the exact contours of that, but I don't find that inherently objectionable. And I think there's probably good arguments for a lot of the ways it's actually been used over the last several years. Although, you know, maybe some of the legal arguments haven't been the best, but the policy justifications certainly are there. It gets different when you get to a sunset. And that is precisely because of this issue with the presidential veto. There used to be a time before a 1983 case called Ines V. Chadha when Congress could set up different kind of post-enactment approval processes, different kind of contingent authorities that would allow it to exercise influence and to kind of roll them back if the president did something that Congress didn't like. But that's no longer an option. That was found unconstitutional in Chadha. And because of that now, really, Congress is stuck with two choices. Either they have to give a very narrow grant of authority and run the risk that they'll either going to be inhibiting good policy and, you know, hurting negative outcomes for the United States, or particularly in the war powers context, maybe driving the president to start making more aggressive assertions of his own Article II authority, which would undermine congressional authority in a whole different way. Or on the flip side, they have to give very broad authorizations, but then deal with the consequences when they don't like what the president is doing, and all of a sudden they need two-thirds of both bodies to pull that back. It's a really difficult circumstance. I sympathize a lot with Congress in that. And I think that, that decision and the consequences we're seeing echo out in ways that maybe a lot of people didn't fully anticipate in a variety of contexts, particularly in national security context. But it doesn't change where we are now. You can delegate all sorts of authority to the executive branch about making lots of these decisions, but without some sort of hook to pull it back if it goes too far, you know, it's hard in my mind to justify it. Now, a sunset doesn't have to be something that's really prone to manipulation. Just as we see this bill setting up all sorts of fast-track procedures and ways to lower the burden and make it as easy as possible to enact legislation that questions, maybe not quite as easy as possible, but certainly easier than it would be otherwise to enact legislation to roll back some of these presidential steps, you could see it go the other way. You could see fast-track procedures to fast-track bills to extend the AUMF every 4 years at the president's recommendation. And you could see other provisions like wind-down periods. When Senator Paul introduced an amendment to the NDAA last year proposing to revoke the 2001 AUMF, he gave, I think it was 6 months, essentially saying, we pass this today. When it gets enacted, 6 months from now, the AUMF will expire. You could build that in here saying if it fails to get authorization, then it has a whole year to wind down. You know, there's a lot of ways to sweeten the pot and make it easier to swallow for the executive branch. But without that hook, Congress is just giving away a lot of authority. And it makes me very nervous.
What about, I've never thought about this before, so this is probably not something I should even try to raise off the cuff like this. But what if you had sort of a rolling sunset in the following sense? So let's say you set the four-year term, make sure it's off election cycle, but then you add fast-track renewal procedures that come into play way before the deadline. So the underlying policy objection you always hear out of the White House is, my God, we'll be signaling to the enemy that they can just hold out another year. We're going to hit the sunset, and then the Americans have to pull out. What if that was always, unless it seemed like it should be repealed, what if that was always 3 or 4 years off? I mean, that has a lot less bite when the sunset doesn't come into play for 3 or 4 years. But every single year, there's a fast track where Congress is basically invited and the poll is greased to get Congress to vote on a renewal that'll extend it 1 year on the four-year cycle. So the four-year cycle is always off until Congress doesn't want to keep renewing it. Is that better than status quo? Is that just too complicated? Does that do any good? It would force every year a vote, which I think would actually be rather healthy.
I don't disagree with that. You know, there are different ways to calibrate it. I could see folks in Congress essentially saying, we don't know what's going to happen in that four-year interval, and saying, so, you know, it's not as effective. I think that's certainly an improvement on the status quo, where we never have these votes, right, and where the authority is going to continue indefinitely, barring some sort of judicial intervention, which certainly doesn't seem likely based on the record of the last 17 years, although maybe that will change. But absolutely, there's a lot of ways you can adjust and tweak a sunset so that it's not the sort of cataclysmic event that, frankly, this administration particularly has kind of cast it at. But they're not alone. Other people have said the same thing. And so, you know, I think there need to be a harder look at that by folks in the Senate.
To change topics real quick, something popped into my head that I want to make sure we mention. One kind of quiet part of the bill amends the National Defense Authorization Act for fiscal year 2012, section 1021. That's the detention authority. That's the only time Congress has kind of revisited the 01 AUMF to do anything on detention. It said after years and years of litigation that got settled approving more or less what the executive branch was doing, Congress back then said, all right, yeah, we'll codify that now that you guys agreed with the courts that exist. That provision is codified or is going to be amended to match up with the scope of authority the new statute provides. One thing this does is it removes the shadow of potential lack of statutory authorization for detention in cases involving AQAP detainees, Islamic State detainees. We mentioned earlier that we don't have anyone at Gitmo who's from these hard cases, these edge cases. The president has said repeatedly that he wants to bring new people to Gitmo. There are many of us who think that one of the various reasons why that hasn't happened. First of all, you don't actually have a lot of targets of opportunity for this, but there certainly are some with the Islamic State. And one reason why it hasn't happened nonetheless could be that there was fear that a judge would say, I've now got a case about the scope of the AUMF applied to these far-flung groups. I don't think it applies to them. With this new bill, I think that goes away, and that shadow is pretty much lifted. And one wonders, would this actually be an inducement to the White House to perhaps go ahead and support the legislation? And is that a good or bad thing? I leave it to the audience to decide.
So as a final question, what are your predictions about what happens next?
I think that it'll certainly get out of committee, and I think that that'll be the end of it, unless, and the wild card would be that forcing function I mentioned earlier, unless the administration gets into a situation where they really do need to bring someone, they feel they need to bring someone to Guantanamo, and then the lawyers in the administration convey the case that this is a real big advantage, that this legislation would really be worthwhile and frankly doesn't cost too much.
Yeah, I think it's certainly a very likely scenario. You know, I can see a universe where this gets out of committee because it seems to have a substantial support from a number of big players there already. Then it gets onto the floor, and I think you're going to see pushback from a variety of different directions. And frankly, I don't think we've seen enough folks in the Senate, and certainly not the House, actually have to talk about and take a position on these things to see how it's going to play out. And with, you know, Speaker Ryan leaving, we don't know exactly where the House's leadership will be on this, although I think we can guess, probably very similar to the administration's position. So it's really hard to game out where this goes. You know, I will say I'm ultimately very skeptical of this as a standalone bill, simply because the Trump administration has been very clear that it does not want it. And again, it still has the ability to veto this, and that certainly seems like there's unlikely to be two-thirds in both houses to move past this. But there are ways that Congress has in the past been able to get things to go to the president where it's very hard for him to veto it. The classic example is hanging this as one more Christmas ornament on the National Defense Authorization Act, which is coming up. It's complicated to do that. That involves a whole other committee in both houses. It's the Armed Services. It's not the Foreign Relations Committee. There's a variety of reasons why that may be more complicated, that the somewhat optimism we have for this in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee may not extend elsewhere. But it's at least a vehicle that seems like a hostile administration, particularly if this is sweetened in a number of ways, may be willing to accept it. Otherwise, it seems unlikely to ultimately be enacted into law.
I can think of a forcing function for that. So what I have in mind here is the fact that there are large numbers of Islamic State fighters and family members who are in the custody of SDF or U.S.-supported forces in Syria who are basically being held under sort of makeshift conditions in what amounts to quasi-military detention pending quasi-trials, including large numbers of foreign fighters from Europe. It is really easy to imagine that SDF cannot hold in place, even if they want to, for the next several years, let alone for the duration. My understanding is that, in fact, it is a hot topic of diplomatic conversation between the United States and Europe and others. What is going to happen to these people? Because most of our European allies, I gather, really don't want them back. And there's a bit of a game of chicken going on as to, well, what's going to happen to them? Sooner or later, the changing circumstances of SDF forces on the battlefield, given the way things are currently trending with increasing stability for the Assad regime and the increasing interest on the part of the Trump administration to actually withdraw U.S. forces, very easy to imagine that there's going to come a day where the SDF forces are going to say, all right, we're done running that facility. Come pick these guys up and do something with them, or else we're just walking away with the doors open. When that moment comes, hopefully long before that moment comes, there's going to have to be a solution. And I can imagine the administration deciding that for a subset of those Islamic State fighters, the ones they think are really most likely to be dangerous going forward, they may decide they really want to be able to bring them to Guantanamo as part of the solution. And at that point, if they have any sense at all, they'll wish they had this bill.
Bobby Chesney, Scott Anderson, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Please take a moment to tell your friends and followers about the Lawfare Podcast on Facebook and Twitter, and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both as twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.